Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, how one century-old high school holds the key to Phoenix's Black history. And a Navajo zinester is out with her first book of poetry. But first, a Valley man is heading to prison for posing as a psychologist. Scott Keeling was sentenced last week to a year and a half in prison after the Arizona Attorney General charged him with an illegal scheme to defraud the state's Medicaid program for millions. The AG said he used a forged college degree from UCLA to pretend he was a licensed psychologist. He treated patients and even had a license plate that said Dr. Psych. He's not the only one. ABC 15's investigative team has been uncovering cases of unlicensed healthcare imposters, and reporter Ann Ryman joins us now with more. Good morning there, Ann.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming in. Let's start with Scott Keeling and this case and what the AG says he did. What were the charges?
So basically, he's accused of fraudulent schemes, and essentially what it's alleged that he did is he was using the state's Medicaid system. And he was billing through it, and he did not have a code or permission to do so.
Hmm. So he managed to bill the state's Medicaid program for a whole lot of money. How much?
The AG believes it's in excess of $3 million.
How much of this had to do with the fact that he was calling himself a psychologist, said he had a doctorate, et cetera?
They believe quite a bit. It was a very big reason that he did this. He started this business in 2023. And he, many people went to work for him at his previous business. For years, they thought that he was actually a psychologist and that he had a degree from UCLA. And so they were as surprised as anyone else when the criminal charges were announced to find out that this man that they had known for years was not a psychologist and did not have a degree.
Right. So this all came to light in a really interesting way I want you to tell us about. It was because of a child custody case that he was involved in. Tell us about that.
Yes, exactly. It was actually a father who uncovered this. It was a child custody case, and the father, as part of the court case, they went to court, and there was these court documents that were filed. And on the court documents was a document from Dr. Scott Keeling, a psychologist, who said he had seen the children, and in his professional opinion, they were better off with the guardian than they were with the father.
Hmm.
And the father immediately became suspicious, and he thought, who is this Scott Keeling? He began investigating. He looked into it. He found that he couldn't find him licensed as a psychologist. He checked with the psychology board. They had no record of him. He even at one point hired a private investigator to kind of dig deeper on
mm-hmm.
it. And when he was pretty confident that this guy was not a psychologist, he contacted the attorney general. He contacted the Phoenix Police Department. He contacted the psychology board. He also called me at the time.
Huh.
And so we all started our own kind of independent investigations, and we all came to the same conclusion, which is we could find no record of this man being licensed in Arizona.
Did UCLA have a record of him having graduated there, as his diploma would have made you think?
No, not at all. In fact, they told the attorney general that the document was an outright forgery.
Hmm. So talk about the state psychology board and its role here. Like, how did they respond to this? What did they do?
So they actually investigated it, and they called him before the board, where, according to the minutes, I was listening to the audio of it, and he told them that he was, in fact, a psychologist. They could find no record of it. And so they issued him what's called a cease and desist, mm-hmm. which is basically you're not a psychologist. You have to stop portraying yourself as one. At the same time, the attorney general was conducting its own investigation. And the attorney general is the one that actually then came in and filed the criminal charges against him.
Okay. Will any of his former patients, I wonder, like, find out now at this point that they were treated by someone who was not, in fact, a psychologist?
Well, they're aware of it because what happened is Access, the state's Medicaid system, basically shut down his office
mm-hmm.
and because he was not able to operate it anymore. And so the patients were all aware they abruptly lost their treatment. So they had to find treatment elsewhere. Furthermore, many of his employees received maybe a day's notice that they were all of a sudden out of work.
You spoke with a few of them, like you mentioned. What has Keeling had to say about all this? He maintains his innocence.
So he has not said much, if anything. As part of his sentencing, they had to prepare this pre-sentencing report. But that was actually sealed by the judge because there was sensitive information in that. So we don't know what Keeling said to the judge. You know, often these pre-sentencing reports will give background on the person and talk about their childhood and why they may have gone the route that they did. And so we don't know. He did make one statement in court that he believed this arrangement that he had was legal because he had an attorney look it over. But the attorney general is not buying that argument. They're saying they said if had the case gone to trial, there's plenty of evidence that would emerge that shows that he knew that this was an illegal arrangement.
Interesting. Okay, so this is not the only case like this that you have uncovered in recent years, right? Like, what other kinds of cases of unlicensed healthcare kind of practitioners have you found?
So the most recent one comes to mind are dentists. There are sometimes dentists who are, they might have some training, you know, maybe like hygienist training. I recently covered one where there was a woman who had some sort of dental training in another country, and she was here advertising as doing dental work, doing fillings for a sharp reduction, you know, $100 fillings, right? Which sounds great until you realize maybe that person didn't have the correct training for it. And so she was actually charged by the attorney general. So sometimes you get the people that are outright, they don't have the degree at all. And then often you also get the person who may have been trained a little bit elsewhere, and they're coming to Arizona and advertising services. Like, you know, it happens with massage therapy.
Right.
I was recently at a massage board meeting where they were issuing three cease and desists to people who were portraying themselves as massage therapists when, in fact, they were not.
And they can cause harm when these kinds of professionals are pretending they're professionals licensed and trained, especially for something like dentistry. And we've seen that harm play out, it sounds like.
Definitely. You need a lot of the health professions that are regulated and licensed. You need quite a bit of school and training, college to get that degree. And, you know, the danger there is that, you know, if you're being treated by somebody who is not, in fact, has the experience or the knowledge to do it, you could end up with great harm to people.
Yeah, yeah. The AG says cases like these kind of medical imposter cases are on the rise, too.
Yes. And I think that the big thing to underscore, I think, here is the importance of checking any medical professional you might have in your life or your children's lives or your parents' lives. You can easily go to the board that regulates them and you can check them out. Not only check them out to see if they have a license, but you can also look back 5 years of their disciplinary history and see if they've been in trouble with the regulatory board. And that can be a red flag if you know, the person that you're dealing with has a number of problems with the regulatory board.
Very interesting. All right. ABC 15's Anne Ryman joining us. Anne, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Northern Arizona is famous for its aspen trees, and a multi-decade study looks into how they're being affected by climate change. Among the findings, there are a good number of smaller, younger aspens and a good number of older ones, but not all that much in the middle. Mike Stoddard is a forest ecologist with the Ecological Restoration Institute, Northern Arizona University. He spoke with my co-host, Mark Brody, and they started with the fact that there's this kind of missing middle among the aspens.
A great observation. That was one of the kind of like the surprising findings that we found in this study. Aspen are known for their resiliency to disturbance, and they're often described as a disturbance-loving species. But not all disturbances are equal. Aspen respond well to some types of disturbance like fire, which can clear the way for new growth. However, other disturbances like drought may stress the trees without the benefit of renewal. And so what we're seeing is with this prolonged drought and these other disturbances, we've getting a lot of aspen regeneration, but something's keeping them from growing up into tree status.
Well, what are the implications of that if those younger, sort of smaller saplings aren't reaching maturity?
Well, without a balanced age structure or size structure, the forest lacks resiliency. Mature trees can provide stability, but they won't last forever. And if there are not enough younger trees to provide that replacement over time, then we've got a sort of a long-term problem in terms of like renewing these aspen forests.
So you mentioned that aspens generally don't necessarily mind disturbances, but not all disturbances are created equally. Is this just one disturbance that's causing this, or is this more of like a perfect storm of disturbances that are sort of conspiring together to cause these problems?
I think you hit the nail on the button there. There's a lot of things kind of interacting together. In the 2000s, we experienced probably one of the most extreme droughts in the Southwest in modern history. And then with the lack of fire to stimulate that regenerating growth for aspen, so you don't have fire, you have extreme drought, and then you have grazing. So you have an abundance of grazers like elk and deer that are restricting those new aspen suckers, is what they're called, into reaching tree size.
Well, so what can you do about any of those? I mean, obviously, there's not much humans can do about drought, but the fire and the wildlife, I would imagine that there is something that can be done, right?
I think one of the crucial elements that can be done is just having adaptive strategies. So in this particular unique setting, it's a wilderness setting. So there's not a whole lot you can do in a wilderness, but you can manage fire. You can manage herbivores outside of the wilderness. And so when you do have disturbances, you can basically adapt to the aspen needs following these disturbances. For instance, we just had a fire in 2022 called the Pipeline Fire. Super devastating to the community of Flagstaff and the Peaks. But one of the silver lights following this fire is the recruits that are coming, aspen recruits that are coming following the fire. Mm-hmm. We already have 6 to 8 feet tall aspen stems. And likely a lot of that has to do, you know, having this fire that stimulated new growth and then past management of elk and deer.
One of the factors we haven't really discussed is climate change. And I wonder what role that might be playing. Specifically, again, looking through some of the research, something called oyster scale, an insect that kind of sucks up tree sap that maybe is having more of a run on these trees than it has in the past.
Sure. So we're lucky on the San Francisco Peaks. We haven't observed oyster scale yet. They seem to not like elevations above 9,000 feet. And I think a lot of it has to do with the cold. It's still cold enough to deter them from living beyond their normal life cycles. But in the elevations below, and definitely on these more extreme southern aspects, they're being inundated with these oyster scales. I guess you'd call them a pest. But they're native. They've been around. They just, with climate change, as things become warmer, they're hanging on longer. And so they're having a more prolonged effect on aspen and their recruits.
How optimistic are you, or what are the chances that aspens will be able to adapt to these disturbances, maybe as they have adapted to other kinds that maybe they're more resilient toward?
You know, I'm one of the people that love to consider the glass is definitely half full.
Okay.
And, I feel like these ecosystems are a lot more resilient than we give them credit for. I believe in the last 20 years, management has definitely come together as a cooperative unity for solutions, working together, finding solutions, adapting, I think is the way that we're going to move forward. And it's going to definitely help these forest ecosystems.
Well, so when you mention the word management, that kind of raises the question that, you know, these ecosystems are resilient, but do they need human intervention to be as resilient as they need to be, or can they do it on their own?
Well, that's a great question. A loaded question, that is.
Sure.
So just taking the example of the pipeline fire, looking at the response that we're seeing, yes, it seems like aspen are doing what they do best, following disturbance, without human intervention. How long that lasts, how long is just going to be time and a lot of monitoring to see how these respond.
All right. That is Mike Stoddard, a forest ecologist with the Ecological Restoration Institute at Northern Arizona University. Mike, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, how brutalist architecture took shape in Phoenix.
So some of the earliest buildings were social housing, were schools, were libraries, were city hall buildings. We were building democracy, and we were not building palaces.
A longtime Valley architect on the purpose of brutalism. But first, when we learn about the civil rights movement in school, Phoenix is not often the setting. But there is a rich Black history here, and our next guest gave me a firsthand look at some of it recently.
Yeah, this used to be part of where the students ate, but this is the archives room now. So this was basically a cafeteria.
Wow, there's a lot back here. The first thing that jumps out at me is this whole rack of old trophies here, huh?
Yeah, well, Carver was known for its sports acumen. Some folks say that it was part of the underbelly of segregation in many ways because he put all of the Black students and a few Latino students in one school. And one of the things that they knew that they could excel at was athletics, right? Because they felt as though the gridiron and the court would be where they could level the playing field. Once the ball was thrown in the air and once the whistle was blown, segregation really didn't apply.
That's Matthew Whitaker. He's a longtime Arizona historian and now the executive director of the George Washington Carver Museum and Cultural Center in what's now Phoenix's Warehouse District. When it was originally built south of the railroad tracks in 1926, though, it was on top of a former landfill. And its purpose was to educate the students of color in Phoenix in the era of segregation. Today it's a museum, and it's in the process of a rebirth under its new director, Mr. Whitaker. He recently showed me what they're uncovering about our city's Black history in the nearly 100-year-old building's archives, along with curator Paul Tallarisio. And we began with the history of segregation in Arizona schools and why the school was built.
Most of the folks in the legislature wanted segregation. They passed a measure ultimately giving the schools and the state the option to segregate if they wanted to. So they didn't outright outlaw it, but they gave permission for them to do so. Phoenix, Tucson, Flagstaff opted to segregate. And between Tucson and Phoenix, that's 90% of the state's population at the time. So by Phoenix Union High School District and the district in Tucson segregating, the state effectively became segregated.
And this was built out of that. Were they segregated within school districts before that, the students?
They were extra legally, right? It was de facto segregation. Even in the schools, for instance, the Phoenix Union High School District, Black and brown students were segregated from white students, sometimes within the same classroom. Teachers would put a sheet up in the room, and the white student would sit on one side of the sheet, and the students of color would sit on the other side of the sheet. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out what side of the sheet that the white teachers would stand on and who they would talk to. So the Black parents in particular were furious at this. Not furious at segregation per se. What they were arguing was, you said separate but equal, but there's nothing equal about this. So if we're going to segregate, give us our own school. That call eventually led to Carver being built.
So the building and working to preserve it all these years later, like, why did you come and do this? You were at ASU for a long time. You're an historian.
I was born and raised here. My mother moved here in 1959 from Texas, right up the street from Carver in the Matthew Henson Housing Project. In fact, one of the units that's been preserved is the unit that she lived in. So I have a lot of love and affinity and affection for this particular area. I heard about Carver growing up from just about everybody in my family. My mom didn't go to school here because of when she moved here. But I knew that it was a sort of beacon light of hope and pride in the community. And as a historian, who wouldn't be attracted to that, right? I want to see Carver thrive and be around for another 100 years to be able to teach the lessons that it can teach that are embedded in its history.
So let's look around here a little bit. So we have documents in the archive. There's dolls. There are pictures.
In my hand is the commencement ceremony invitation or program from 1927. Wow. So you can look at this. And one of the things that jumps out at me, in addition to all of the information here, is the mantra, the class motto. We strive not to equal, but to excel, right? And it's something that was, I think, most Black people in our homes, we were taught that it was not enough to be as good. We had to be better in order to even get a look, right? So our margin for error was pretty little. So I hold this fragile commencement exercise invitation in my hand, and these are the type of things that we have here. Because as Phoenix is the fifth largest city in the country, and as more people move here, they want to know our history, and they want to know the history of diversity here. And they come to Carver. Mm-hmm. They'll Google us or ask around and say, where do I get, you know, Black history in the city? And we want to be that repository. So folks are starting to give us more. We have somebody like Paul who's always searching for new stuff. I mean, he actually found new photographs, unseen photographs of a race riot in Phoenix in 1967. That's not something to smile at, but when I was doing my preliminary research on the civil rights movement in Phoenix, I researched and I knew about the riot. I didn't see any pictures of it.
Here it is. Yeah, let's look. This is 1967 race riot, Phoenix, Arizona.
Yeah.
So this is one of the newer photos that we just got from July 27th. It shows white supremacists that were arrested the night after the riot because they had driven through with their weapons and guns and were being antagonistic.
Yeah, one of the things that we noticed in most of the photos we've seen, most of the young Black people being arrested are girls. Right now.
Yeah, this shows police officers, several of them handcuffing and sort of constraining a young woman.
Yeah, and these are kids, mind you, by the way. These are young people. Now, when I did my preliminary research, too, I didn't find anything about white supremacists actually being involved in the riot. But here they are standing arm to arm with police officers. And folks wonder why communities of color often are concerned about the extent to which anti-Black, anti-Hispanic, racist sentiment flows through police departments. And it's because we have a history of those two being conjoined, oftentimes to our detriment. So these images that Paul has found basically affirm what we're talking about. And we're not talking about Reconstruction. We're not talking about 1865 or 1870. We're talking about 1967. This was 3 years before I was born.
So I wonder this because, you know, like we think of the history of Phoenix, and it's interesting to me that you said lots of people are seeking you out and sort of saying, tell me about the African-American history here, because there's not a ton of this in the city. There's not a ton of documenting of it, not a lot of organizations, it's not a huge part of what the story of Phoenix might be considered. It sounds like you're really trying to remedy that.
Yeah, we're trying to remedy it here. It's really a team effort, in part because the lessons that the history can teach us are priceless. Now, in order to exact those lessons, we also have to be willing to confront uncomfortable truths. And a lot of people don't have the stamina and, quite frankly, the courage to confront those truths. They believe that somehow it's going to contaminate our patriotism or our love for the United States. But in fact, we believe that knowing it really can empower us to avoid the type of mentality and thought process that goes into separation, right? That goes into inequity. And there was lots of joy here at Carver, right? So when you interview the elders, one of the things that they'll tell you is, we weren't all thinking about segregation and the fact that we were oppressed all the time. We were kids, right? So we were thinking about tennis. We were thinking about lacrosse or ROTC. We were thinking about home ec, who our favorite teacher was. We had one of our elders who just recently passed, met her husband here because she had stolen his bike, and he confronted her outside of the school about where, you know, that looks like that's my bike. And she said, well, it is your bike. I took it, right? So it worked out because I got married. So one of the things that Carver can teach people is, even in the face of horrific things happening, beautiful stuff can happen. That's just what human beings do. So it's those type of stories that just kind of keep us motivated. We often say that the walls in Carver talk.
You walk through it, you hear them sometimes?
Oh, yeah. We walked through and we're hearing sometimes that my kids who kind of grew up here, I used to bring them when at board meetings, they were really small at the time, are convinced that they played with little kids here that nobody ever identified. So, yeah.
Thank you so much, Matthew, for showing me around. I appreciate it.
Oh, no problem at all. Anytime.
That was my conversation with Matthew Whitaker, historian and executive director of the George Washington Carver Museum and Cultural Center in South Phoenix. You can see photos of the archives at the Carver Center, including those photos they uncovered of the 1967 race riot, on our website. That is theshow.kjzz.org. Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Blue corn is an important food to the Navajo people. They eat it shelled, roasted, dried corn, and ground in sweet or savory blue corn mush or flour. It's part of their creation stories. It's used in ceremonies and songs. And it's the title of our next guest's new book of poems, Blue Corn Tongue. Amber McCrary is a Diné poet and zinester who explores the significance of not just blue corn, but juniper, saguaros, and more in her first book of poetry. It is a book of poems, but it also tells a love story, her love story. I spoke with her more about it.
I would say this book is my desert love poem book. It's a love story between the writer and the muse, and the writer is coming from a point of view from a Diné perspective and a blue corn perspective or a juniper tree perspective or a Colorado plateau perspective. And from these perspectives, they're looking at their muse, who is a saguaro or the Sonoran Desert or white corn. So just different elements of people, place, and plants.
Right, because you're telling this story of this Diné woman who falls in love with a man from the Autumn Reservation, right? From southern Arizona, from a very different part of this state.
Yes, from the Autumn Reservation.
And I want to talk more about that kind of parallel or maybe contrast that you make throughout this. Like, the book takes place in parts and in different sections, and some of them have to do with, you know, the sort of northern Arizona juniper that you talk about, where the Navajo Nation largely sits. But a lot of this is about the Sonoran Desert, which you were not super familiar with, it sounds like.
Yeah, I was not familiar. I came to Phoenix, you know, through college and going to ASU. But I'm originally from northern Arizona, so the deserts are completely different from, you know, northern Arizona and southern Arizona. So it took a while for me to get acclimated to heat and and to nothing but heat and sun. And it talks about that too.
Yeah, yeah. So you have this blue corn symbology and ideology here, but then you also have a lot of significance of the saguaro, which represents the Sonoran Desert, obviously the place, it's the only place the saguaro cactus grows. Talk a little bit about using that image here as well and what that meant.
So I use the saguaro image in a lot of ways where it's my muse. And I also have poems of like a self-portrait as a saguaro and what it must be like being a saguaro in the desert, especially when there's climate change happening or there's urbanization happening. And I also try to look at it in a perspective of my muse being a saguaro and and like his connection to saguaros as an autumn person and the significance that saguaros play within his culture and like how they see saguaros as relatives and kind of similar to, you know, how Navajos we see like junipers as relatives or different plants up north as relatives. It's kind of similar down here in the south.
So the poems in this book are disparate. Like, they tell a story, but some are really devastating about pain, about trauma, about alcohol, about land grabs, right? But then there's so many that are just about love, about joy. You know, there's a sense of humor in this as well. How did you balance that?
That is something I feel like I always have in the back of my mind as a writer. It's really hard when it comes to trauma and just the whole idea of like, you know, trauma dumping or I wanted it to be in my book because it's part of my life, but I didn't want it to be my whole story because I feel like my whole story isn't just doom and gloom. I mean, if I focused on that, it would be, but I also wanted to focus on what was happening in my life at the time. You know, I was falling in love. Humor has something that's always been in my life, and that's one of the biggest things that keeps me going. And that's something I wish I wrote more of in my book was humor, but you know, there's always future books.
There's always future books. Let me ask you about the formatting of some of these poems, Amber, because some, you know, look like a regular poem, but a lot of this is really experimental, maybe is the word. I mean, you've got poems that are written like in the shape of mountains and some that are in the shape of a flower, or like the first one in the book is like a series of circles kind of written concentrically. Talk about that and yeah. why you chose to do it that way.
Yeah, I think a lot of it was just me having fun and playing. And, you know, I have a background in zines, and that's kind of where I had the most fun, where I was just kind of like placing things in certain areas and seeing what I like and what looks good or what, you know, pops out at me. It's kind of hard for me to stay within like a certain clean format. And I felt like my outlet for sure was a lot of the experimental poems where I didn't feel like I had to stay within a certain boundary and a certain way of doing things.
You also intersperse and use words from your native language throughout this, like from Dene, like that are, and you're not really translating them. You're just using them kind of without trying to make it clear to folks what they mean. I wonder that must have been intentional. Like, what was the idea there?
Yeah, it was intentional. I think it's for people that want to know the language. You know, they can look it up. but it's mainly for maybe a Dene reader because they might know the word, or they can go and ask their Che or their mom, what does the word mean? And then hopefully it can, you know, bring out a conversation between them two, or they can tell a story about what this word means. And I just feel like there's so much with Dene words where it's not just like, oh, and this is what it means, like in an Arabesque. And I don't know. I feel like that's the part where there's nothing wrong with trying to do more work. You know, you have to do the same with William Wordsworth or another poet that you might not know a word and you have to go into the dictionary and look it up. Yeah.
Yeah. I love that idea. All right. Well, can I ask you to, at the end here, read one of these poems for us, maybe an excerpt?
Sure. So it's on the page, it's a capital L with a slash through it, but it reads as, so it's called, "The beginning of our language doesn't begin with written word, rather through tongue and sound. Tongue and sound separate me from Shanala. I could never ask her if it's true when she was a teenager, if she was excited to take the bus from Hard Rock to California to learn to read. Instead, her family married her off to my Nali man. She is the only woman I have ever seen cry with her entire body, soul and heart. She smiles, but I know the ocean of emotion that lies beneath her earth. I drive home from Kintlane to Othamlan. I crack open 30 pistachio shells with my teeth. The pistachios were not open until they met my teeth. How does language open? With sound, with mouth, with vision. There are so many ways language can open and shine. I wish I could reach my Nali where my language lacks. All I can do is smile and shake her frail hand."
All right. That is Amber McCrary, author of the new collection of poems, Blue Corn Tongue. Amber, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. A new film by a Phoenix native has people talking about architectural history. The show's Sam Dingman spoke to one of the Valley's best-known architects to learn more.
By now, you've probably heard that the film The Brutalist, directed by Scottsdale's own Brady Corbet, has been nominated for Best Picture at this year's Oscars. It tells the story of a fictional Hungarian architect named Laszlo Toth. In the movie, Toth is renowned for designing municipal buildings, giant, imposing structures made of concrete. He's considered a master of the architectural design philosophy known as Brutalism, which had its heyday in America in the 1950s and 60s. You can see examples of Brutalism right here in Phoenix. If you've ever been to police headquarters, no judgment, or driven past the Executive Office Tower, where Governor Hobbs works. And when you look at those or other Brutalist buildings, you might think that the name comes from the stark, unadorned aesthetic of the exteriors. But that's not quite right. The name actually comes from the French phrase béton brut, raw concrete. And the word raw, it turns out, is just as important as the concrete it's describing. I learned that and a whole lot more from a conversation I had recently with John Meunier, a renowned architect in real life. John's house, which he designed himself in the Brutalist style, appears on England's National Historic Register, and he's the former dean of the College of Architecture and Environmental Design at ASU. When we spoke, John told me that Brutalism is as much about style as the ethics that inform that style.
After the Second World War, we had an awful lot of restructuring to do, not yes. just buildings, but actually society itself needed restructuring.
Yeah.
So some of the earliest buildings were social housing, were schools, were libraries, were city hall buildings. We were building democracy, and we were not building palaces. We were not building for the rich and the powerful. We were building for the people.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit more about this phenomenon of using the concrete and not disguising the concrete as the core element of the building.
The roots of that go very, very deeply. They go back into the Middle Ages. And one of the things that people liked about those buildings is that the stone that they were made of was what you actually saw. And the structure and the building were the same thing. The building wasn't built around the structure. The building was the structure. That notion of a kind of raw honesty became very, very attractive to many people. The raw concrete of the building, the raw steel of the building, the raw copper of the building. And that gives me an opportunity, of course, to refer to the Phoenix Public Library.
Yes.
And interestingly enough, the copper was not treated. It was allowed to turn its color into a dark, dark brown, not left as a shiny metal.
Yeah. So as you talk about this, there's something rather poetic about your characterization of Brutalism, this idea that we're building democracy, this idea that this was about the removal of artifice. But of course, to the modern eye, a lot of this design can look aesthetically somewhat cold, somewhat, some say it reminds them of prisons and this sort of thing.
I think particularly in America, and when Brutalism became a style rather than an ethic, it was adopted by very large organizations America is the country of capitalism, and so the very large buildings of capitalism were done in this style. And they were pretty damned oppressive. They were huge in scale. They tended to make the human being diminutive. They lacked a kind of richness and what I call intricacy. My own particular theme of my work is intricacy, and these buildings tended to lack it. That was not true of the original Brutalist buildings.
So one of the things that we see in the film, The Brutalist, is once he completes this work that he spends the bulk of the movie putting together, you see in the film that though it is mostly comprised of this sheer concrete that's just arranged in certain angular ways to have a kind of effect, he has put in these very intentional design elements like slit windows towards the top, which are meant to evoke the prison camp that he was in. Is that the type of intricacy that you're referring to that might have been found in these more classical forms of brutalism?
You're talking to a certain extent about another issue, which is what architecture means. I mean, it does have references. And one of the references, obviously, is to rhythm. And one of the problems of many disliked brutalist buildings is that they have a very monotonous rhythm. A multiplicity of scales is very important for me in intricacy. Everything from something that you can hold in your hand to something that you can fit your shoulder into to something that you can walk through, something that you barely fit in to something extraordinarily grand.
Like which, a big window where light can come in or something.
And so intricacy is, in fact, something that often is not associated with brutalism, but in the hands of really good architects, you will see it is.
Yeah. So tell me, for you personally, as someone who, as you mentioned, has worked in this style and with this ethic, presumably, what drew you to it as a young architect?
Well, you know, as an Englishman, I was brought up with certain strong ethical codes. My house, for example, is built out of the cheapest possible bricks, but I made a very grand house out of it. And one of the ways you can do that is not by spending a lot of money on materials, but by spending a lot on proportion and scale. For example, in my house, the living room is 10 feet tall, whereas the bedrooms are only 7 foot six. And the idea was that the living spaces are for groups of people, whereas the bedroom is for individuals or couples. And so a different scale is appropriate to them. The 10 feet is higher than normal. And so people find it actually slightly grand. Here's this ridiculously inexpensive house with a very grand space in it.
May I ask, how much did it cost for you to build the house when you built it?
Less than £5,000.
Wow.
Certainly one of the great pleasures for me is this notion of using one's skill, not necessarily one's wallet. Architects on the whole are not motivated by money. Architects are motivated by hoping to have made a contribution to the quality of life, and that contribution is not only a material contribution, it's also a cultural contribution.
Do you have a sense of what the popular response to this style was? Do you think people tended to appreciate the ethic behind these structures at the time?
I think in many ways this word brutalism was a tragic mistake.
Because
in the hands of really good architects, you're dealing with something that is actually precious and life-enhancing.
Yeah. I would say rather than brutalist, perhaps they should have gone with structures of truth or structures of democracy, perhaps.
Yeah. I mean, there's something attractive about the idea of brutal strength.
Sure.
But I'm much more interested in brutal honesty. That, in fact, we're not afraid to be honest. That, in fact, we believe that being honest actually will improve the quality of our lives.
Wow. Well, John Meunier is an emeritus professor and former dean of the College of Architecture and Environmental Design at Arizona State University. John, thank you for this conversation.
It was a great pleasure and very nice to meet you.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.